Thank you, Professor Sinitsyn, for the gracious introduction and the invitation, a great honor to present this lecture. It's good to be here among so many friends. Most of us gathered here today strive to contribute to scientific knowledge, whether by a case report or an original scientific paper or a review or teaching residents and medical students how to think. Yet the scientific literature and even historical reviews do not illuminate the human elements in the process of discovery. I'd like you to join me in penetrating behind the curtain of formally written articles and prestigious prizes to observe the human dimensions of science. The scientific researcher is generally viewed as detached, objective, dispassionate. Nothing could be further from the truth. In this regard, the truth is often startling. The truth is that scientists are subject to ambition, competitiveness, envy, and even guile as any person. Many of us, I believe, have had an experience where an accomplishment is not received due acknowledgement and credit, and perhaps unjustly appropriated by somebody else. The truth is that academic researchers compete for such essentials as funding, promotion, salary, tenure, and status. As most humans do, scientists seek recognition for their work. In the way of the world, this is nothing new. Leon Letterman, a Nobel laureate, known for his impish wit, has nailed the issue. Quote, "Yes, Virginia, scientists do love recognition, but only since Pythagoras." The truth is that in some cases, scientists, yielding to these pressures, may engage in scientific misconduct. How pervasive is this today? One significant measure is the prevalence of retraction of published scientific papers, the forced withdrawal of spurious articles based on fraud or fabrication of data or plagiarism. The result is shocking. In the past decade, there has been a tenfold increase in retractions. Some scientists are repeat offenders. Take the case of the Dutch psychologist Diederik Stapel, who committed academic fraud in over 40 published papers. Then there's the South Korean plant scientist, Hyung-in Moon, who faked other scientists' email addresses so he could review his own papers. Or Jan Hendrik Schoen, a physicist at Bell Labs, who published a peer-reviewed paper in prestigious journals every 8 days, cleverly basing his fabrications on anticipating where his field of nanotechnology would likely develop. This is like shooting an arrow into the side of a barn and then drawing a bullseye around it. Lifting the veil on scientific discovery reveals to us the human dramas that underlie not only the coveting of recognition, but also great conflicts over priority and credit. To be first is to garner recognition and rewards. To be second is to be forgotten. Nowhere are the stakes higher than for that pinnacle of scientific honor, the Nobel Prize. When truly important research begins to take shape and the leading researchers find themselves fantasizing about being candidates for the Nobel Prize, early symptoms of the disease called Nobelitis manifest. MRI has had an exceptionally tempestuous genesis. Its use is now so widespread that everybody seems to know somebody who benefited from the study. Today, it is a multi-billion dollar industry with more than 70 million scans performed worldwide each year for medical diagnosis. The tempestuous genesis of MRI has much to teach us. In my book, Prize Fight, I recount a score of bitter conflicts over allocation of credit in the awarding of Nobel Prizes, but the episode involving MRI exposes the full dynamics. It involved an explosive clash of personalities, guile, deceit, and rampant self-interest, challenges to the basic concept of scientific behavior, legal suits, and finally validation by the United States Supreme Court and denunciations in the international press. It involved a 30-year battle, a prize fight, a blood feud between two protagonists, the details of which I have become intimately familiar. One is Raymond Demadian, shown here in this composite image on the left, a research physician and an expert in biophysics at Downstate Medical Center in Brooklyn, a tragic hero with Olympian strengths and flaws. His seminal contribution established the biological basis of MRI. I not only professionally encountered him over the years, but recently interviewed him at great length over many sessions. His protagonist was Paul Lauterbur, here on the right, a chemist at Stony Brook University, whose flash of insight ultimately served as a cornerstone of magnetic resonance imaging. When I was chair of radiology at Stony Brook, I gave a conjoint appointment to Paul as research professor of radiology and came to know well his activities. Eyewitness interviews and archival research provided further details. Each had a distinct character. Demadian is brash, contentious, reactive. One of his postdocs speaks of his complexity, quote, "Demadian is extremely bright, extremely creative, and extremely inventive. He is also very dogmatic." In contrast, Lauterbur was reserved, non-confrontational, adaptable, but operated somewhat stealthily. Since the early 1950s, chemists had used a technique called nuclear magnetic resonance spectroscopy to obtain information about the internal structure of molecules. It was based on an earlier discovery that nuclei of atoms are magnetic. For this discovery, I.I. Rabi had been awarded the Nobel Prize. The machine used then was a hollow magnet that could hold a sample no wider than a pencil or perhaps a finger breadth. In March 1971, Demadian published a seminal paper in the journal Science titled "Tumor Detection by Nuclear Magnetic Resonance." He reported the groundbreaking observation that there are differences in relaxation times in malignant tissues. A chasm had been bridged. Enthused Demadian, I could now distinguish cancerous tissue from normal tissue by NMR signal. The paper would in time be designated a citation classic. With the training of a physician as well as a biophysicist, Demadian excitedly jumped to postulating an NMR scanner using relaxation times to scan the human body, quote, for detecting cancer in tissues. It was simply a leap in imagination. His application for a patent for this was granted in February 1974. It illustrated an electromagnet shown in cross-section, equipped with bean-shaping NMR transmitter coils and radio frequency probe mounted on a helical track. It yielded no image, but rather a chemical fingerprint. It certainly looks familiar to us. At this point, Paul Lauterbur enters the scene. An expert in the field of NMR for many years, he was familiar with Demadian's science article, but considered the idea of building a human machine was rank foolishness. But he thought further about the problem. A colleague provides us with an eyewitness account of Lauterbur's eureka moment. They were eating at a fast food restaurant, and on the second bite of a double-decker hamburger, "Wait a minute," Lauterbur exclaimed. "If we applied field gradients of known shapes, we could get NMR signals emitted from each part of an object so that they would disclose their spatial location. We can make pictures with this thing," he exclaimed. "We can make pictures with this thing." With tremendous insight and intuition, Lauterbur turned magnetic field gradients, one of the most problematic issues in NMR, on their head. Excitedly, he bought a small spiral notebook at a drugstore. He spent that night refining his thoughts and neatly writing his proposed theory. In 3 pages, he outlined his approach of using a variety of linear magnetic gradients with different orientations to elicit different radio wave frequencies, that is, relaxation times, from which an image could be computed. In the last handwritten sentence on the 3rd page, as we see here, Lauterbur's brief notes cite Damadian's breakthrough contribution in his 1971 Science article, clearly acknowledging Damadian's role in his thinking. This point would later garner a lot of attention. Lauterbur submitted a report to Nature, but it was initially rejected. The reason? The journal found it to be, in their words, quote, of trivial importance. After a personal appeal and minor revisions, it was accepted. His publication of only 840 words is counted as one of the 21 most influential scientific papers of the 20th century. It illustrates 2 glass tubes of water in a field of magnetic gradients and the spatial image of protons. However, its potential was not enthusiastically grasped at the moment. It was published in the March 16, 1973 issue of Nature, with the added conclusion that the technique, quote, should find many useful applications in studies of the internal structures, states, and compositions of microscopic objects. The editors had chosen to delete the words, quote, and macroscopic, close quote, that Lauterbur had written in the tagline, perhaps because they were unconvinced by the fuzziness of the image and by the prospect of applying his method to macroscopic imaging. And Lauterbur has since acknowledged, I still did not know how it would be useful in medicine to have a method for making pictures of the body, since I knew nothing about medical science or clinical practice. Nevertheless, what was the reaction of the academic community of NMR chemists to Damadian's insight and vision? These were, after all, Lauterbur's colleagues, many in positions of granting research funds by agencies, particularly at the National Institutes of Health, the NIH, and the National Science Foundation. They acted as typical of societies who feel their vested interests are being threatened. They simply closed ranks, viewing Damadian as an outsider. Damadian increasingly found himself marginalized and cut off from research funds. Yet, in his mind, he had opened the door, others rushed to cross the threshold, and he was left ultimately holding the doorknob. What were NMR chemists doing for the past 20 years, Damadian rhetorically asked during one of my interviews with him. They were doing chemistry, he exclaimed. As an MD, I had a completely different dimension. I had treated people with disease, I had seen them die. You don't forget stuff like that. I believe 1,000% if I had not made the discovery and proposed the scanner, I believe that MRI would not exist today. Even though Lauterbur acknowledged Damadian's priority in his earliest private notes and in applications for grants, for 12 years after his breakthrough 1973 Nature report, for 12 years, he never cited Damadian's original contribution in his numerous publications and presentations. Not a footnote, not a bibliographic reference, not an interesting aside comment. In short, a self-protective disavowal. Damadian, becoming convinced that Lauterbur was out to steal his discovery, feared he was being written out of history. In fact, in 1977, when Lauterbur imaged not only a tumor in a mouse, but also its growth, he chose not to publish the finding. Evidently, since it would validate Damadian's T1 and T2 concept in tumor imaging. Damadian felt he was forced to resort to a number of stratagems for survival in a hostile environment. He boldly founded his own journal, molding peer review to his own perspective to facilitate prompt publication of his articles. Basically, however, it can be argued that what really matters is whether the experiments can be reproduced and the thoughts have integrative and predictive value. Recourse to a self-published journal is not without precedent. The great 19th century neurologist, Santiago Cajal, was so apprehensive that publication of his enormous output would be delayed, which would threaten his rightful claims to priority, that he financed his own journal and sometimes wrote every article in it. Cajal went on to be awarded the Nobel Prize in 1906. Years later, Demedian commissioned the publication of an 838-page volume highlighting the history of MRI pioneers, including, of course, himself. These actions can be considered as ones of either forceful initiative and resourcefulness or of shameless self-promotion. At an international conference in the summer of 1976, Lauterbur showed an MR image of a slice of green pepper. A pepper is 99% water, lending itself to a picture clearly demonstrating its architecture, its anatomy. His announcement as the sole author created understandable grievance among his research team in attendance. Thereafter, a cross-sectional image through a finger, a human finger, was shortly published in the BJR, the British Journal of Radiology, by Peter Mansfield, a physicist at the University of Nottingham. This first alerted radiologists to the medical potentials of MR, or of magnetic resonance imaging. A major tipping point was reached, as if a firing gun was triggered. The race was now on. Lauterbur had used a unit the size of a small refrigerator with a small aperture, restricting the size of material he could image to such things as a chicken wing or a mouse. Nothing sharpens a scientist's drive for priority more than the realization that he is in a race with another researcher. And nothing galvanizes as the potential of a Nobel Prize. Demedian was determined to win that race. He clearly realized that only an image of the internal parts of the human body would strengthen his priority claim. He undertook the Herculean effort of constructing his own whole-body machine. Along with his two postdocs, they labored for a year through 18-hour days, 6 to 7 days a week, to construct a 1.5-ton behemoth. They dubbed it Indomitable to capture the spirit of their struggles. It represented the first MRI system able to fit a human. It was 10 feet high with a 53-inch opening and was made using 150,000 feet of superconducting wire that was manually wound and soldered together. Demedian took it upon himself to be the first human subjected to the unknown consequences and exercise caution by having a cardiologist in attendance. But he proved too large for the antenna vest that had been so laboriously constructed. It took a few weeks, but the thinner of his two postdocs was finally persuaded to stand in. They employed a system that lacked any gradients and slice selection, having a small sweet spot fixed in the isocenter of the magnet, requiring the subject to be moved incrementally and requiring about 4.5 hours for the slice. On a holiday weekend in early summer in 1977, an axial image of the mid-chest was acquired. The results were exciting. Clearly displayed were the heart, aorta, lungs, and the ribs and muscles of the chest wall. Historically, this image is equivalent to Röntgen's famous X-ray of his wife's hand. Demedian felt he was triumphantly validated. It proved, he says, that, quote, you could put a human in a magnet and produce an image. Everybody knew then that you could do it. Before that, there was widespread decision, close quote. The report with its image was promptly published, and Demedian received telegrams and letters of congratulations from several Nobel laureates and NMR researchers. Across the Atlantic Ocean, Peter Mansfield at Nottingham University paid a tribute. You have to admire the guy, he said. He set his mind to it, and he pulled it off. Anyone who builds a magnet, especially a supercon, must be an unusual man. Close quote. No one else had the imagination or hubris to jump to the construction of a whole-body machine. But the accomplishment failed to make much of a ripple in the scientific community. In this period, advances in MRI were being made not by the giant commercial vendors who were preoccupied with refining and selling CT units, but by researchers at universities and academic clinical centers. Many radiologists, bedazzled by the capabilities of CT, thought that deriving an image from a magnet was far-fetched, or at the best, did not offer competitive advantages. Demedian's grant applications continued to be denied. Lauterbur, in the course of his career, would receive more than $11 million in funding from the NIH and the National Science Foundation. Demedian's frame of mind at this point is illustrated by this cartoon. A researcher, having unraveled detailed advances, concludes, "This is fine as far as it goes. From here on in, it's who you know." Utterly frustrated, Demedian left academia a few months later and founded Phonor Corporation for the manufacture and marketing of imaging units. Ironically, the NMR community castigated him for, quote, going commercial. Notably, it was not until 1985 that Lauterbur publicly acknowledged Demedian's contribution. This belated admission so inflamed Demedian that he lost all restraint. And at an international meeting in London of MRI radiologists, he launched into an unspoken diatribe against Lauterbur, to the shock of all who witnessed it. Yet for Demedian, fate soon played its hand. On June 30, 1997, he won a suit against GE for violation of his 1974 patents regarding T1 and T2. He was awarded $128 million, and a similar total from the other vendors, including Hitachi, Siemens, and Philips. The Supreme Court of the United States denied GE's petition for appeal, and legally, this clearly affirmed Demedian's priority. But fate also played another hand. At 3:30 in the morning on October 6, 2003, Paul Lauterbur's phone rang, and he was prodded awake by his wife from a deep slumber with the words every researcher dreams of, "It's Stockholm calling." Both he and Peter Mansfield were being awarded the Nobel Prize for MRI. Demedian got no such call. The third slot, which was available, was conspicuously left open. Demedian was struck to his core, but typically he did not remain passive. He took out a series of full-page ads in major American newspapers and a major Swedish newspaper, excoriating the decision and appealing to the Nobel Committee and to scientists and physicians worldwide. In the 98-year history of the Nobel Prizes, such an attack was unprecedented. Some speculate that one additional factor influenced Stockholm's decision to spurn Demedian. He is a creationist, believing, for example, that Earth is only 6,000 years old. To some, however, faith and science are not incompatible. For example, Dr. Francis Collins, head of the NIH in America, can comfortably accommodate science as a matter of faith. He responds to a new scientific discovery with the thought, "Wow, only God knew before." Now, what are we to conclude from this tempestuous episode in our history? Personally, I believe that the Nobel Committee erred in not granting Raymond Demedian the third slot, along with Paul Lauterbur and Peter Mansfield. This assertion is based on several of his seminal contributions. The original conception of using MR for whole-body screenings of living humans, the fundamental discovery of MR differences among normal tissues and between normal and cancerous tissues, which provides the biological basis for MRI, and the construction of the first full-body human MRI machine. To those in the NMR community, Demedian's campaign was viewed as an extension of his long-standing abrasive behavior. But the Nobel Committee rewards scientific achievement, not good manners. Scientific achievement, not good manners. Now, why is all this important? Why do the details of this conflict merit our attention? On one level, it illustrates the vindictive retaliation when an entrenched community, in Demedian's case, the NMR chemists, feels challenged, and the weaknesses of peer review and of the integrity of award processes. Excuse me. While facts can be established, the determination of who merits priority in discovery requires judgment. Proper attribution plays an essential role. Every discoverer embraces a point of view: this is my work, my legacy, my place in history, my bid for immortality. Every schoolchild asked who discovered America answers Christopher Columbus. Yet Columbus is said to have not known where he was going, where he was when he got there, or where he came from upon his return. Let us ponder here, in conclusion, a few fundamental questions. What are the main factors that determine the attribution of priority and credit? Is it the one who first conceives of an idea, who first uncovers the potential of a new observation or finding, or is it the one who recognized the pattern and meaningfulness in order to establish it as an advance, or is it the one who develops and nurtures it to bring it to humanity's benefit? Why is all of this important? Because priority is cherished as a universal right deserving proper recognition. Because we are affected so directly by scientific advances. Because we need to be sound in our judgment of the allocation of funding and resources. Because profound benefits and consequences to society may be at stake. Thank you.